Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, nuclear weapons generate a lot of media interest when it comes to the question of whether Iran is trying to get them. But when the topic is eliminating nuclear weapons altogether, as at the now concluding UN meetings on the non-proliferation treaty, media could hardly care less. We'll talk about the NPT with Alice Slater of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and Abolition 2000. Also on the show, Mark Zuckerberg says he wants to improve the lives of billions of people. So why is Internet.org, the Facebook mogul's new application intended to provide limited free Internet access in the developing world, meeting such strong resistance? That word limited was a clue. We'll hear the rest of it from Tim Carr from the group Free Press. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. So seriously do elite media see themselves as taking the issue of terrorism that virtually any policy can get a respectful media hearing if it's sold as fighting it. That's why it's so critical how media appear to define the term terrorism and specifically whom they associate with it. Which brings us to the case of Robert Rankin Doggart, ordained Christian minister from Signal Mountain, Tennessee, who, according to his plea agreement, told an FBI informant of his plan to attack the residents of a Muslim community in upstate New York. "Those guys have to be killed. Their buildings need to be burnt down," Doggart says on tape. The buildings he planned to destroy included a school, a mosque, and a cafeteria. The town of Islamberg, which Doggart called Target 3 and declared on Facebook, was vulnerable from many approaches and must be utterly destroyed, was among the communities highlighted with a helpful map by Fox News' Bill O'Reilly as cities with radical Muslim organizations. So, a violent plot against innocent people with actual steps taken. Doggart recruited gunners and tested his M4 rifle, and featuring religion, inflammatory media, even social media. Yet it somehow wasn't a story, outside of a few places like the online Chattanoogan, the Chattanooga Times Free Press, the Arizona Republic, and the Rock Hill, South Carolina Herald, and then a few online outlets like Think Progress and the Daily Beast. No New York Times, in other words. No Washington Post or USA Today or Nightly News. If that's changed by the time you hear this, it will still be big media's initial response that's significant, and the evidence that they just don't fearmonger around cases of terrorism that don't fit the profile is still unavoidable. It isn't that we want more and more people to be labeled in media as terrorists, or as thugs, for that matter. It's just that such terms have to be used consistently, if at all. Well, media's response might be related also to the fact that the FBI and U.S. Attorney's Office didn't hand reporters a press release on Doggart's case, as they have in some other cases. So maybe add a dollop of laziness on top of the bias, I guess. When the White House announced on May 16th that a team of Delta Force soldiers had gone into sovereign Syrian territory to kill an alleged ISIS commander and a few dozen others, media slipped into frictionless transmitter mode for the Pentagon and White House's action movie narrative, featuring compelling details about the rescue of a Yazidi slave, hand-to-hand combat, and precise fire, including literally shooting around women and children being used as human shields to rack up a toll of 40 extremists. While the New York Times, as journalist Adam Johnson pointed out, offered the disclaimer that accounts of the raid, quote, came from military and government officials and could not be immediately verified through independent sources, close quote, CNN aired a CGI simulation of the story as told, cementing it as reality in viewers' minds. The difficulties of reporting independently in a war zone are real. But for media to therefore present official claims as authoritative until or unless they can be proven otherwise is highly problematic. Maybe worse, though, is how media buried the lead here. that while the White House has acknowledged hostage rescue missions in Syria, this is the first time it's admitted that ground troops have been deployed in the country for expressly military purposes. It seemed important to some. Some folks tweeted about it, for example. But meanwhile, the New York Times was hosting a debate on whether we should intervene in Syria, including a fellow from Brookings who warned of the humanitarian risks of opting to remain disengaged. If the press corps are going to cite polls telling us there's popular support for various military operations, they need to also make clear to people when those operations are underway. And finally, the May 14th Wall Street Journal reported that the number of complaints by civilians about New York City police officers has fallen to its lowest level in 12 years. The report attributed the drop in complaints to a decline in the number of interactions the NYPD has had with the public, including the number of times officers stopped and frisked people and the number of arrests and summonses officers handed out. Well, there's a logic there. Fewer interactions with police, fewer brutal interactions with police, all else being equal. But the journal seems to hint that there's a price to pay for the drop in complaints, saying that the report, quote, came a day after a poll found that the majority of New Yorkers support broken windows policing, the theory that going after small crimes prevents much larger ones, close quote. But is that justified? Has the lower incidence of interactions with police meant an increase in serious crime? A sincere inquiry would centralize that question, but the journal glosses over it, as close as it comes being a reference to polls saying near 90% of the city's residents say they're worried about crime, and a majority don't agree with how Mayor de Blasio has handled policing issues. It's an odd approach, given that the NYPD releases detailed statistics on the actual amount of crime in the city. And these show that over the same time period when New York's police have been making fewer stops and fewer petty arrests, major crimes are down. Robberies, which a New York Times write-up described as a bellwether crime that erodes public perception of safety, reached their lowest levels yet recorded. So the Wall Street Journal left out what might have been the most interesting part of the story. The NYPD's backing away from stop and frisk and reduced interest in small-time busts was accompanied by a 5% reduction in major crimes, in direct contradiction to what one would predict from the broken windows theory that is still the official crime-fighting ideology of New York City. Indeed, that New York Times story cited a professor who noted that the NYPD's philosophy has remained the same between the Bloomberg and the de Blasio administrations. Papers like the Wall Street Journal likewise seem reluctant to let evidence get in the way of a deeply held worldview. You are listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Given the abundant, dramatic reporting on whether Iran wants nuclear weapons or should be allowed to develop them, why was there virtually no coverage of the UN meetings now concluding on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the pact meant to curtail and indeed reverse the growth of such weapons? It sounds like a logical question, and yet to ask it requires a certain political and media naivete. The U.S. government has long treated the NPT as meaningless, for us anyway, and elite media tend to echo that imperious presumption. How could the conversation around nuclear weapons and the NPT be different? Alice Slater is the New York director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. She serves on the coordinating committee of Abolition 2000. She joins us now by phone from the UN. Welcome to Counterspin, Alice Slater.
I'm delighted to be here, and I'm really happy that you're giving this important conference some coverage.
Well, why don't you start by telling listeners a little about the origins of the NPT? What did the signers commit to, and how has it actually played out?
Well, the NPT was negotiated and signed in 1970, and at that time, five nuclear weapon states, the U.S., Russia, China, England, and France, promised to give up their nuclear weapons if all the rest of the world promised not to get them. And everybody signed except for three countries, Pakistan, India, and Israel. They went and got their own nuclear weapons. But all the other countries signed. And the treaty also had this Faustian bargain to sweeten the pot for the non-nuclear weapon states. They promised them an inalienable right to so-called peaceful nuclear power. In 1995, they came back together to have a review and extension conference because they only did it for 25 years to say, how are we doing? And, of course, by this time, the U.S., Russia, and other states had gotten many more nuclear weapons instead of getting rid of them. And they extended the treaty indefinitely with promises to review it every 5 years. And now we're in 2015. And there are still 16,000 nuclear weapons on the planet. 15,000 of them are in the U.S. and Russia. All the other countries, which is France, England, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and now North Korea, have 1,000 altogether. So it's really up to the U.S. and Russia to make moves on this. And now they're negotiating. It's business as usual. In the meantime, there's been this incredible effort to change the conversation because the International Red Cross made a statement 2 years ago about the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons, that if they were to go off, you could have nuclear famine, nuclear winter, nobody could actually help people. And there was a series of conferences outside the UN system in Oslo, then in Mexico, and last December in Vienna, where civil society showed up in this incredible new campaign, I Can Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And in Austria, the Austrian government in December gave a pledge to fill the legal gap for nuclear disarmament because the non-proliferation treaty, the promise that the nuclear weapon states gave was to make good faith efforts to eliminate their nuclear weapons. But nobody actually prohibited nuclear weapons. Like there's a treaty to ban chemical weapons. There's a treaty to ban biological weapons. But this is a loophole in the law. So this ICAN campaign is trying to move forward with a ban treaty, nuclear weapons, and it's doing it without the nuclear weapon states. They're not ready to do this. But to get all the non-nuclear weapon states to create a legal taboo against nuclear weapons. It's very exciting. We're up to almost 100 countries that are signing this humanitarian pledge to ban nuclear weapons. And the conference ends tomorrow. We don't know how it will end because there was fabulous language in the agreements that were put in about humanitarian consequences and the need to eliminate nuclear weapons. And the nuclear weapon states have negotiated all of that out. So they're now in a locked room somewhere. The doors are closed, and they're trying to figure out if they can get a consensus document at the end of this four-week meeting. But whether they get a consensus or not, the rest of the world is ready to move forward and get a negotiation going forward to ban nuclear weapons.
Well, it's very exciting indeed, and another example of people kind of working around what seems like a kind of stagnant existing process to say, you know, if you're not going to do it, we'll find another way. Well, I know that Barack Obama had a statement delivered by John Kerry for this conference, and it was about, yes, we have a shared vision of a world without weapons, but there are no shortcuts and each step must be carefully taken. I take it it's this kind of incrementalist, slow-going approach on the part of nuclear states that is the reason that non-nuclear states are looking for another way.
Exactly, and civil society. You know, I mean, there's huge amounts of citizens working on this right now all around the world. And when Barack Obama made his vision statement for nuclear-free worlds in Prague, where he got the Nobel Prize for it, in his speech he said it might not happen in my lifetime. Hillary Clinton misquoted him and said it might not happen in several lifetimes. And now they keep proposing this step-by-step basis, which is incremental and which doesn't get rid of nuclear weapons because we have a commitment in the United States to spend $1 trillion over the next 30 years the two new bomb factories, the new submarines, missiles, and airplanes to deliver new nuclear weapons that they're still designing. This is insane. I mean, we can't use them. We only use them twice. America was the only one to ever use them in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We killed over 500,000 people with two bombs, and they're still getting cancers and mutations into the next generation. So it's insane for us to keep these weapons and to spend another penny on anything except dismantling them.
I think people don't necessarily realize that the NPT is not just about no countries getting new weapons. It's about getting rid of the ones we have.
Exactly. And that's the way our government is selling it, as a non-proliferation measure. And yes, someday, you know, in the distant future, maybe not in my lifetime, we'll get rid of them. But meanwhile, if you read Article 6 of the treaty, it says that the nuclear weapon states promise, make good faith efforts to eliminate their nuclear weapons. And that provision was interpreted by the International Court of Justice, which is the highest court in the world, saying that there's an obligation to conclude negotiations on a treaty to eliminate nuclear weapons. But the U.S. does not accept that, and neither do any of our partners in crime, you know, Russia, China. Although, in order to move forward on nuclear disarmament with Russia, we have to stop expanding NATO, and we've been putting new missiles in Turkey, Romania, Poland. Russia and China offered a treaty to ban weapons in space, and the U.S. blocked it. Gorbachev wanted to cut all the nuclear weapons with Reagan, and they agreed, and then Reagan wouldn't give up Star Wars, so Gorbachev pulled the deal off the table. Putin asked Clinton to go to 1,000 nuclear weapons each. We then had 10,000. And if the U.S. and Russia would cut to 1,000, then we can call everybody else to the table because they have less than 1,000 and negotiate a treaty to eliminate everything. Well, he said, I'll do this with you to Clinton if you don't put missiles in Eastern Europe. Well, Clinton said no. And then Bush walked out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. So when we're demonizing Russia now and Putin, we blew it. I mean, we had a chance to get rid of these things. They were open to it, but not if we're going to keep maintaining we're going to be superior in space or on land in NATO countries. Why do we have a military alliance? I mean, we promised Gorbachev when the war came down that we wouldn't expand NATO. We've broken every promise we made to them.
A lot of missing history. We don't really know what's going to come out of this UN conference, but in any event, there is growing momentum around eliminating nuclear weapons.
Yes, from the grassroots, but not from the governments that are running the institution. Like right now, they're in the back room trying to hammer out a consensus statement that will say nothing and walk away and say, well, you know, we save the NPT for the next 5 years. And there are a lot of countries, we're lobbying them to not give in and not give up on the strong language that they were proposing. And then when we come out of here to go forward with the ban treaty, start a negotiation outside of this treaty.
We've been speaking with Alice Slater of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation and Abolition 2000. Thank you so much, Alice Slater, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much.
Why would anyone be suspicious of a billionaire's plan to bring free internet to millions of the world's poorest people? Plenty of reasons, it turns out. Concerns are coming thick and fast about internet.org, Facebook mogul Mark Zuckerberg's latest venture, which he promotes as an effort to improve the lives of billions of people and the right thing to do. What is internet.org exactly, and what's the problem with it? Joining us now to discuss this is Tim Carr, Senior Strategy Director at the group Free Press. He joins us now by phone from New Jersey. Welcome back to Counterspin, Tim Carr.
Hi, Janine. How are you?
Just fine. Well, what is internet.org?
Well, I'll tell you what internet.org is not. It is not the internet as most people know it. It is an effort by the Facebook founder, Mark Zuckerberg, to connect billions of people around the world who don't have access to the internet. What's happened globally is that a lot of people of all incomes now have cell phones that are capable of streaming data. And what he has proposed to do is to partner with cell phone carriers in countries like Brazil, Indonesia, India, and provide what's essentially an app that gives people a very limited taste of internet access. And it's no surprise, Facebook is a large feature of that. It gives them access to Facebook, gives them access to Wikipedia, to BBC World Service, a few limited portals to the internet. The problem, of course, is that he is promoting this as full access to the internet. But what it does is it provides Facebook with the potential to be the gatekeeper to the online world for billions of people. And it's a very limited online world. And it's caused an uproar. There was a lot of pushback in India recently, for example, because people there feel that if you're going to give people internet access, you have to give them access to the whole universe of the internet and not let Facebook, a company that has its own profit motive in controlling where people go online, be the ultimate gatekeeper.
Facebook would presumably be selecting which media outlets would be able to be part of this.
Yes, Facebook ultimately decides what content is available via the service. And there are some issues there. Not only, you know, does Facebook sort of become the gatekeeper to all content for all people, and we're talking about as many as 4 billion people on this planet who don't now have access to the internet, but it also gets to apply its business model. And Facebook's business model, it allows itself to harvest the data of our usage. So there is a profit motive there as well, which may not be charitable.
You'd have to wonder, why would a country cede this whole sector to one company from the get-go just as a business decision? Why would you want Facebook to kind of take over that whole sector?
Well, the carriers see it as a feature that they can offer to customers. It's access to a snippet of the internet where the data costs are being covered by Facebook and not the customer. So you think the customers would find that appealing. I think that the problem that I see with a lot of this is that Facebook's very, very ambitious global campaign to promote internet.org has overshadowed a lot of very good local efforts. If you go to places like Indonesia and India and Brazil, you'll find that there are already efforts on the ground, in some cases in operation for more than a decade, that are attempting to give low-income communities, rural communities, access to the whole internet. And I think if Zuckerberg were truly sincere in wanting to get people connected, he might spend his hundreds of millions of dollars in supporting these local efforts rather than this one vehicle, which ultimately only promotes the business of Facebook.
I read one article that started out saying, who knew giving something away for free could generate so much hate? And, you know, there's this idea that the internet is something that entrepreneurs like Mark Zuckerberg invented and gifted us with, and now people are acting entitled and ungrateful, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that, you know, we need to understand that having access to the internet is not a luxury. It's essential. It's critical infrastructure for anyone who wants to advance themselves economically. There are educational opportunities. There are healthcare opportunities that people can avail themselves of by virtue of getting connected. So increasingly in the United States and around the world, people are recognizing that and that it should be treated in many ways, like we treat the electricity grid, or like we treat roads and mass transportation as an essential public service. The more governments, the more people recognize that aspect of the internet, I think the better off we are. If we put too much hope in these sorts of projects like internet.org, we may be leading people down a somewhat perilous path.
So then the kind of pushback against internet.org might have the positive effect of calling attention to other more, let's say, democratically based efforts.
I think it's interesting because Facebook is so prominent. It has become an opportunity for a lot of the local advocacy groups to organize, not only to organize within their countries, but there has been a global effort to push back against internet.org. Last week, about 65 organizations signed on to a letter to Mark Zuckerberg complaining about internet.org and suggesting that he choose another route, making sure that he is indeed in support of principles like net neutrality, that he's truly pushing for universal access, that he's respecting the privacy of internet users. So there has been this response, which has been a positive. There's been a mobilization of internet rights, internet access advocacy groups, consumer advocates around the world who are looking at internet.org and thinking about better ways to solve this problem.
We've been speaking with Tim Carr from Free Press. You can find their work online at freepress.net. Thank you very much, Tim Carr, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. That's fair.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network and receive more of our analysis and research. It's also where you can show support for Counterspin if you're so inclined. We would appreciate it. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.